Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Her Living Room. I'm your host, Amina Brown, and this is Her with Amina Brown. I hope y'all are enjoying a little bit of springtime. And if you are able to, I hope you are on your way to getting vaccinated. By the time you hear this episode, I will be fully vaccinated, which basically means I will be hugging all over my mom, grandma, and sister. I experienced such a sense of relief when the vaccine was available to me, and I realized there's still a lot about the past year that I'm recovering from in a lot of ways. Many of us have experienced grief in various ways over this past year. Some of us have lost loved ones. Some of us lost jobs, lost relationships, experienced the collective grief of the hard things that were happening in our country and in the world. My therapist told me that grief has to be processed. Grief is best not stuffed down or ignored. Grief may pop up at what seem like some of the most inopportune times, but if we take time to let grief sit with us, we can process it and walk through it at whatever pace we can. In this week's episode from the Her Archives, which was recorded in the before times, I'm talking with author, educator, poetry slam champion, and one of my favorite poets, Teresa Davis. Listen in as Teresa shares with me how we can use writing to process grief and the helpful ways we can walk alongside someone who is grieving. Check it out. Welcome back. I am so excited we are having author, poet, educator, poetry slam champion. She has written two books of poetry, After This We Go Dark and Drowned, A Mermaid's Manifesto, both published by Sibling Rivalry Press. Welcome, Teresa Davis. Oh my gosh, y'all. First of all, I have like literally 17,000 things that I could be talking to Teresa about. So I'm going to try and not do that and just pick like at least 15,000 of them and save the other 2,000 for later. But I just want y'all to know, first of all, I've lived here in Atlanta 20 years and Teresa Davis has been a pillar of our poetry community. I feel like here in Atlanta, but I think in general, you are a pillar just in the poetry community nationwide, because this is how I get like poetry street cred. When I go places and they'll be like, oh, you live in Atlanta? What other poets you know there? I'm like, I know Teresa. They'll be like, oh, okay. Then they like accept me. So not only is Teresa just an amazing performance poet herself, she's also a fabulous host. I actually hosted a couple of bouts with Teresa at the National Poetry Slam competition when it was here in Decatur. And I always tell the story in front of her. She's rolling her eyes, tired of hearing it probably, but she's like hosting and I'm supposed to be like, I don't know, I'm supposed to be keeping track of some numbers or some something on the side. And I'm like taking notes like, okay, after introduces poet, then says these things. I mean, it was just, she is just a master of her craft. So Teresa, thank you for being here. I always start out wanting to ask an origin story question. Okay. So you became someone who works with words, who helps other people find their words too. When you look at young Teresa, would you say like you would expect this is what you were going to become? Or when you look at your young self, was your young self on a totally different road or path?
Well, my young self was raised by two poets, and being raised by creatives, it's always interesting times when, you know, it's not enough money or the contracts are not coming. You take them a serious camping trip that lasts a week, you know, because they don't want you to ask why the light's not working right now, or do we have water, or, you know, so they got real creative of hiding the fact that we were like living on poets' salaries, and which you can hear the word po in that word poetry. You can hear it loud sometimes.
Thank you for making that connection.
Sometimes it's loud. So I definitely did not see myself being a poet. I avoided it at all costs. And when you're the daughter of artists who do a lot of community organizing and are part of a lot of festivals and activist type things, you sometimes find yourself being the kid who has to memorize a poem to perform at said rally or wherever they're doing. So I was that kid a lot. I didn't resent it as much as I was just like, again, you know. So when I found myself as an adult actually doing poetry after my dad died and being introduced for the first year and a half that I performed at open mics or wherever event, whatever event would invite me, and being introduced as Alice Lovelace's daughter. Huh. You know, I felt like I really came into myself the first time she was introduced as Therese Davis's mother. Mm. I was like, Papa Collar, you have arrived.
Come on, Papa Collar.
Now you could be you. You've earned your voice. So yeah, I definitely did not see myself being a poet. I did want to do journalism real hard for a while there. I wanted to be an investigative reporter, you know, kind of a mix between Daphne of Scooby-Doo and April from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Mm. Just be like all up in people's yes. grills
yes.
and finding mm-hmm. out the stuff, the dirt, the lowdown. When I got into college, I was like, okay, no, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to do something else. But I don't know what it is. And then I stumbled into like, oh, wait, you're a writer. Who knew? Your parents probably did, but it's okay. We're all on the same page now.
That's right. I love it. I love it. I wanted to have Teresa to come on and be a guest and just share some things with us, because one of the things that I love about your work is that it's very visceral for me of an experience. It's visceral for a lot of us, all of us who are sitting in the audience when you share these stories from your life. And sometimes it's visceral because I'm just laughing my head off about yeah. it. And yeah. sometimes it's visceral because you write about being in love so well. And sometimes it's visceral because it just makes us cry. You know, I, yeah. and I think there have been times the crowd has cried with you, that the piece also, even though you may have shared it many times before, that it still is a visceral experience to you. And I think that is such a credit to you as a performing artist, because I think sometimes there can be this thing where you kind of, you're going on stage, you're kind of hitting the autopilot, you've done the thing, but there's something else to really be present in the work.
Yeah.
And present in how the work may still affect you, or may affect you differently even than it did when you were originally writing the thing, you know? And so part of what I wanted Teresa to share with us is how we process grief. And that's not all of your work,
no.
but that's something that has come up in quite a few of your pieces, just how we can take all the grief that gets stuck inside.
Yeah.
And the page is a place right. where we can put that.
And, you know, grief is not always about physically losing somebody or a person. Mm. It could also be, you know, losing an idea or having something shift so completely that, you know, what you believed is no longer a real thing. That's something also that I think that comes out in some of my work. Like, you know, you have these ideas of what a thing is supposed to be. And like, you know, like I can write about being in love probably because I'm so bad at it. but that wanting to be a part of something that's not for you.
Mm.
And, you know, like I know for me, it's one of my super bad habits is trying to fix something that I didn't break.
Ooh.
And then getting so caught up in like, I know I can, this can work if I could just fix this one thing, but you know, I didn't break it. and this Gorilla Glue ain't doing nothing. I had a thing that happened to me, and we went to this competition in Dallas called DIPS, the Dallas Invitational Poetry Slam,
okay.
where the prize was a giant bowl of guacamole in this beautiful silver bowl.
Wow.
And it was the best damn guacamole I've ever had in my life.
Where does one go to do this?
I know, it doesn't happen anymore. It was one of those things where I went and we did this workshop. In the workshop, back then, I held back a lot because I didn't want to be the poet who bursts into tears every time she opens her mouth or write about sad stuff all the time, you know. And the workshop we did, I decided that I was going to allow myself to be as vulnerable as I could stand. That was I could be very vulnerable in my work when I talked about my job, because I love my job. You know, I was a teacher. I love being a teacher. My kids, I love being a mom. I have not damage them in any serious way, that hopefully they will have great jobs later and can pay for that. I try really hard to like be present in their lives. So I have to, if I'm telling you to show up for opportunities, then you have to show up for yourself. You know what I mean? And so like that workshop, I wrote breathing lessons in that workshop.
Mm.
And this is a poem that is quite old, but it still like resonates with me, and it hits me differently depending on when I do it. You know, sometimes I'm not terribly emotional at all, but I'm still connected to the work. And then other times it just like floors me from out of nowhere. And I think it's because I realize I still have that loss of innocence, that wanting to be with a person, but not understanding how to do that in a way where you're still yourself.
Yeah.
You know, losing yourself inside somebody else is never a good thing.
Right.
You know, sometimes we don't understand that it's not a good thing until we've actually done it. And have to climb back into our own skins and be like, oh, that was icky. Let me get it out of my body. Right. You know, and I think that being able to be present in the work is still me processing it out of my body, but actually understanding that this was a part of who I am. Mm. You know, I come across a lot of people who are ashamed of earlier work. Mm. And they'll say things like, well, I've grown and I don't write like that anymore. I'm like, but you can't deny that that wasn't who you were.
Right.
To do that, I think, does a disservice to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't look at what you've done in the past and where you are now and see the growth in it, you become in danger of disconnecting from your work. And, you know, I value words. I value other people's time. And I mean, if you're going to take the time to come and hear me say words, mm-hmm. I feel like it's my job as an artist and someone who is proud of their work and someone who enjoys sharing, because I believe sharing our stories connects us. We get past our differences and likenesses or whatever. We figure out where we connect, where we overlap. And when my story bumps up against your story, and I want to have a conversation about that.
Right.
So this poem, Breathing Lessons, is about, you know, me being in love with a woman and not understanding what this meant. You know, I did this poem at a showcase at Nationals in Boston, and it was the very first poem. Mm. And the show, you know, finals, 2-hour show. At the end of the show, this couple walks up to me, this man and this woman, white man and white woman. I am not white. I don't know if you know me. And the man comes to me and he says, I need you to talk to my wife. Hmm. And I say, why? And he says, she was in a relationship with a woman when she was in college. And she never had closure with that relationship. And I really feel like she needs to get that closure because I feel like it's holding up our relationship.
Wow.
I love her.
Wow.
And I know she loves me, but I just wanted her to just hug you or talk to you or whatever. And his wife is still in tears. She's been crying through the entire show from that one poem. And see, like, for me, that's connecting. Mm-hmm. You know, I am in Boston and a random white dude connects with my story and is so secure in his marriage that he wants his wife to have the closure that she ever got. Because the whole poem is about closure, about, you know, wanting that closure and understanding who you are now, as opposed to who you were when you were 19 and star eyes and all these other things. And, you know, the fact that the poem can be as old as the poem is and still resonate with people as strongly as it still does. I think a lot of that has to do with allowing myself to be vulnerable, allowing myself to tell that story and feel safe in my words, even if the room may not be safe.
Right.
You know, and I feel like authenticity and genuineness comes across through the voice. The voice is the most powerful instrument in the world. I mean, like, as an educator, I learned real early that the BS in your voice can be heard louder than the authenticity or genuineness of it. So I try to be as authentic and safe in myself as I can. But I think it's really important to take care of yourself. Like when I work with in workshops we get into, you know, prompts or things that may go places you're not ready to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, writers who are listening, I'm sure we've all written that thing where we start going down that road. We're like, wait, that's scab. That's a scab. You're picking it. You're picking a scab. Oh no, now blood. Okay. You're going to be fine. You know, you go there and you're like, oh my God, I can't stop. But this hurts, but that's part of the healing, I also believe. Mm. So I always tell people when I'm working in workshops, I'm like, don't go as deep or be as shallow as you want. Protect yourself first. Mm. You know, sometimes this will take you places you may not be ready to go yet. Don't go in there deep if you can't, you know, swim very well. Feel free to step back from it, take it another direction if you can, or change the topic and maybe come back to that later when you're ready to actually say what your heart is pushing your pen to say. So it's always interesting. And I love it. I mean, I love it. I work with a lot of young people now. It makes me feel empowered to help empower them to share their words and share their work.
How did you learn how to process this in your words, even the places where you may have written things that didn't show up on stage? I know we all have those pieces
there's buckets of poems everywhere.
And maybe no one's ever going to see this.
Right.
And then sometimes you do write it and get to a point where you're like, oh, okay, it would help me and help, you know, some other people for me to share this. But was that something being a child of two poets that you feel like you learned that way? Or how did you learn that process for yourself?
So I come from a family that was very, very close. We had we always sat down and had dinner together. Saturday night was family night, game night, whatever. We had songs that dictated how that Saturday was going to go. You know, you wake up and you're listening to Elton John screaming real loud. You know, you are cleaning the entire house.
All the way down to the baseboards.
And you hear Stevie Wonder playing. You might be going to the drive-in later. We don't even know. So a lot of those things dictated our days and our moving through. But we also talked a lot. Mm. Being able to say, okay, how was school this week? Or what's going on with you? And knowing that the person who is asking the question genuinely wants to hear the answer, you know, and wants to have a conversation with you, not necessarily, you know, berate about you should not, you know, not that, but like not make you feel shame about it, even if it's silly, you know, not to belittle you or make you feel like your voice is not a part of the conversation. And I think that as we grow and as technology and all these things that happen that like kind of distract us from actual social interactions as far as like we just social media it, I think that the art of conversation and talking to somebody is becoming this like weird space where people don't know how to talk to people. They don't know how to ask questions. They don't know how to ask for help even sometimes, you know, because I think we think things are bigger than us and that, oh, my thing is so little, nobody's going to care about this. So I never felt that in my household. I never felt like I couldn't tell my mom, you know, something. I mean, there was definitely some stuff I did not tell my mom.
But that's different from feeling different. Like you couldn't tell.
right. That's totally different, right? When I write, you know, I try to get it out of my body first and then organize it in a way that makes sense. I believe that all poets are storytellers. Yeah. And if I'm going to tell my story and be authentically true to myself, the challenge for me then becomes to what is the metaphor that's going to help me connect to other people, have other people relate to what I'm saying. And like some of my poem is seriously queer. Some of my poem is super black. Some of my poetry is like, oh my God, I'm a mom and I love my kids. And don't you wish you was my kid? it's that tricky space. Like I have poems that while the subject matter may be like, I don't agree with that, but the premise you can't deny, you know? And I think one of the poems that I wrote that other than Breathing Lesson that definitely bridged that divide was Like.
Yes.
Because everybody in the world has liked somebody.
Yes.
You know, that's and you may have favorites. An issue with me liking a girl, but you have liked somebody before.
Yeah.
And you can't deny that. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all had, even if it was us or our children or a friend, a child of a friend, we've all seen that person who thought they was in love with somebody and then it did not go well. And then they're sad, you know, because they thought they was in love and they was in like or whatever. And so we've all seen that. We've all experienced that on some level.
Yeah.
That became the connector of me being able to connect with people who may not be able to connect with directly with the first part of my story, but they could definitely get into the concept of what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it happens by accident, but then sometimes, you know, I really, really work on crafting the poem so that it is definitely doing what I want it to do. It is truthful to my feelings or my experience. And it's relatable.
Yeah.
You know, I think the poem that I worked on the hardest to get the metaphor just right was Cops. You know, knowing that the play on words are there, COPSE, which is a small group of trees, and COPS, which is, you know, cops. Mm-hmm. It's a persona poem where the poem is actually being told from the perspective of a wooden floor.
Huh.
And it's about murdering black boys. And that's how connected you, when you connect with, I feel like, I love what I do. I love fleshing out my own stories. I love figuring out where our stories meet, be you a friend or a perfect stranger. And I think that as a writer and as an artist, I'm always growing. So I'm always trying new things and sometimes they don't work so well, but that doesn't stop me from trying them.
Right.
You know, and I hopefully I'm fostering that in my own kids and the, you know, young people that I interact with and some of the older people that I interact with.
I love the both and of your approach. That the first part of it is to honor your own story and to protect yourself first.
Yeah.
That is the advice you would give to a student writing or to anybody writing. I think that's so powerful because I think sometimes there can be this idea that as artists or as creative people, it's our job to bleed for everyone. It's our job to take our vulnerabilities and just
Yeah, some of the scabs need to just stay on. Some of the scabs.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not,
it might not be healthy for me.
Right.
Yeah. For me to like share some of that. And then I may not be in the right space, you know, either.
Exactly.
To be that vulnerable. And so I think sometimes we can lean that way as artists to feel like, man, I gotta get out here and share this thing that may not be ready, instead of letting it be what it's going to be on the page, whether that was meant for public consumption or not.
Right.
And almost having to let the piece tell you. That's been my experience. The piece has to tell me, I want people to hear this.
Yeah.
You know, and then I know. And then I have to go through like, am I really ready?
Right.
You know, to like take this out here.
I lost my dad. A lot of things changed. Our last conversation where he yelled at me, and this is a man who did not yell. I mean, we would have conversations and the police would show up because we were all very excited about what we were saying.
Right.
It's a Black household. Everybody got to be heard. So we talk loud. Everything's louder.
Yeah.
And he was like furious with me. I didn't know I was clinically depressed back then, but I was super depressed. I was over 300 pounds. I was basically working and then sequestering myself in the house and, you know, dealing with the kids. But they could see that I was sad. Everybody saw I was sad. And he yelled at me and he said, stop trying to disappear. I can see your ass. That's how he said it. I know I'm not supposed to cuss, but that's what he said.
Sometimes you got to get a cuss word out. So and we welcome them.
So he had that conversation with me and he had a similar conversation with each of my siblings during that week. And then he had a massive stroke and I had to take him off life support. So it was one of those things to where I was like, oh, wait a minute. Like he accused me of disappearing and I had to toss that in my head about what does that mean, you know, and understand eventually that you could show up in your life every day and still not be there.
Right.
Every day.
Right.
And not be there. And I was doing that. I mean, I was killing the teaching game. You know, my students loved me. I had a waiting list for my class. My children were thriving. But I was so deeply not happy.
Right.
We had a memorial service for him. And I decided, like, in that moment that what am I teaching my kids for real, for real? Even though I'm awesome teaching in the classroom, can they also see all this other weight that I'm holding onto? You know, and am I teaching my daughters that complacency in a relationship is okay? And what am I teaching them? We did our memorial service for my dad. I took a couple of days off work. I asked for a divorce and I moved. And within a couple of months, I lost 150 pounds. I didn't do anything different. I still ate because I like food. I still did my jobs. I didn't add no exercise regimen in there because I have very particular ways I like to exercise and most of them are explicit. but like I lost 150 pounds, like nothing.
Wow.
Even that, realizing how much weight I was holding on to that wasn't mine, you know, and I started going to Java Monkey. I shared my first poem at Java Monkey and realized that that was a space where I felt like, oh, I can share this stuff and they're not going to blow smoke at me and be like, oh, that was amazing. Somebody will be like, oh, wait, I was confused, you know, and get like honest feedback.
Yeah.
And so that became like my ritual to go every Sunday and have a new piece to share every Sunday. And I did that for about a year, like steadily. I was there every Sunday. And then, you know, of course, life gets in the way. You're like, kids like, I got a birthday party I want to go to. You're like, but poems. Okay, child, I'll take you to the birthday party. Do I have to chaperone? Dang it. Okay. Things started happening and I was there, but not every single Sunday.
Yeah.
My first poem I read there and my loyalty and my believing in what that space does, the person who started it felt comfortable and safe just handing me this baby that he has, you know, had for 15 years. I'm grateful for this community. This community has done a lot for me. And I try, and I don't always succeed, but I try to uplift and be present as much as I can.
Yeah.
And I do realize that everybody in my scene is like considerably younger than me. Sometimes my old 53-year-old brain wants to say, really, that's ridiculous. And can we be a grown up? And that's not always the right thing to say. So I shut up. I don't say anything. I just maybe look confused. I don't know. I can't see my face. Like, I realized the last time I was on the team, I was like, I have children older than everybody on my team.
Right.
That's crazy to me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know? And so like, so some things I was like, I can't relate to that. You know why? Because I'm way older.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting space I find myself in. Mm-hmm. Because I can't relate to a lot of things. Like, my friends will say things in conversations and I'll be like, okay, note to self, don't do it right now, but you need to, what does that mean?
Right, what are IRL? We talking about?
Oh, in real life. Okay, okay, we shortened everything now. Mm-hmm. All right. I don't know all of them. Mm-hmm. Someone told me I was a WCW and I was like, I don't even know what this means.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Woman Crush Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. Now I feel ridiculously old and a little less stupider, but because now I know what it means until y'all change it.
Right, to something else. Then I'm like, I just now learned what that was.
Right, now I gotta learn another
thing. I finally learned on Fleek and then somebody just changed that
around.
You
can't say
it anymore. I don't know what's going on. And I think too, you know, when you were talking about the transition from becoming a person that attended the open mic and then becomes a person who, you know, reads, performs at the open mic, and now being a host, that's one of the things. And I mean, I don't remember asking anybody because how could I have asked to know? But it does take a lot of holding space hosting an open mic because you have this really mixed list of people.
Gosh.
I mean, you've got some people walking up who think they're amazing and they're not. So you have to hold space for how they're going to feel when they finish that poem they thought was so awesome and only two people clap because it was very strange and weird. And then you have people who are fresh off a breakup, crying.
Yeah.
And there they are at that mic,
you
know, sharing their story. And you have to hold this space for them, you know, as well as you've had to also be like, what we not going to hold space for
is
this ignorance.
Right. you know? Keep your misogyny to yourself. And your sexism and all. And so like every once in a while, like Sunday was interesting. I've never had to clap somebody off the stage.
What?
Yeah. I thought I was real clear. You got 3 to 5 minutes. This is not, you know, this is not a TED talk. This is not a.
Right.
This is not an infomercial.
Not the feature.
And you're not the feature. And I got a full list that I want everybody to get in. And I thought the guy, he started off and I thought he was going to stop, but then he didn't. And there were a couple of times where I was like, and then I was like, when he started creeping towards 8 minutes, I was like, and I don't want to clap him. I was talking to somebody who was sitting at the table. I was like, I don't want to have to clap him off. I'm going to have to clap him off. It's my first time doing this. I've never had to do this. Okay. And I just stood up and started clapping and looked at the audience threateningly like, y'all better clap too.
Right now. Clap right now.
So they all got in there and started clapping. And he was cool about it. But my fear is that person who's not cool about it.
Right.
And now we have a whole nother thing, you know,
to have to deal with.
Yeah.
It is this tender balance of always wanting people to feel welcome.
Right.
But having to hold that space in a certain way for respect for people's time and respect for the space and all sorts of those things.
Yeah.
So let me ask you about this. You also are still in spaces where you're teaching students.
I am. Yeah.
And there's one poem you have, and I know I don't remember the title of it right now, but there's this moment in the middle of the piece where you're describing to us how you are helping the students write. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of phrases and questions that they throw back at you as they're writing that just every time I hear you do the piece, I'm like, it almost sounded like one of those terrible knock-knock jokes. Like, I remember you said, how many bullets does it take
to kill a black body?
Like every time you get to that part and I'm like, I'm sitting down watching Teresa tell this story. I was not in the room with the students having to answer that question. And in a lot of ways, I think what's beautiful about your work is, yes, you have your work that you write, that you perform. And you also have this part of the work you do that you're helping other people find their voice and find their process.
Yeah.
What are the things you say when you're going into this room of students, getting them to start processing ideas and thoughts and feelings and current events through writing? How do you get students started on this? And to your point, a whole different generation of students.
Yeah.
from what it was like for you or for me, you know, growing up.
Yes. Whenever I go into classrooms, I always start with the bio poem. Like I get them to do a poem about them so that they understand that there is no wrong or right, that your story is your story. You know you better than I know you. Maybe you have something in common with some of the kids in this room that you didn't know. Every time I've done this, there's at least four or five kids who are like, I didn't know that. I like that too. So now you have the potential to make friends, right? I work primarily with middle school age kids.
Wow. I didn't realize
that. Middle school. Yeah. Middle school is that area where it gets weird. I have a couple more high schools this year, and I like working with high schoolers too, but then it's a whole different challenge because it's like, oh, okay, language for the sake of language. There are better words. This is not just a forum for you to like say all the swear words, you know, in front of a teacher and not get in trouble this time. You know, that's not what this is.
Right.
We're actually going to do some work. But when the young people, we start off with a bio poem, and a lot of them, you know, are afraid to talk in front of people, and, you know, they aren't asked questions directly a lot of the times. A lot of things are assumed about them or answers are assumed. And so I have these kids, they'll start talking and they interrupt themselves like they're waiting for me to, because this is the part when I start saying this that my teacher goes, boy, sit down.
Right.
And I don't. And then I'm like, I'm not going to interrupt you. I'm actually interested in what you want to say, you know? And so I think that that helps a lot. You know, a lot of times when they share that first poem about themselves and I ask, you know, real questions like, you know, tell me three things that you fear. What do you fear? You know, and sometimes I get like weird answers like I fear old people. The wrinkles make me feel like they're going to suck me in. I'm like, okay, that's funny. Write it down. I needed to know that. I'm going to be an old people one day. I do not want to terrify you. You know, I have a fear of sharks. And I'm like, oh, you swim in the ocean a lot. They're like, I've never been in the ocean.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, it don't have to be a rational fear. It's just, but that's your truth.
Yeah.
You know, they share that first piece and then they're pretty generally open to like, okay, what are we doing next? You know, because they do like talking about themselves and they don't get a lot of opportunities to do that. And then, you know, as I go through my sessions, I usually work with, I usually do 10 sessions and then we do a culminating event. And I always tell them like these tools that I'm giving you can actually apply to other parts of your education. Like as you matriculate, you're going to be expected to speak in front of people. This is one of these things that I'm teaching you, you know, and this format right here. This could be used to open a book report. This could be used to open any science report, any report in school that you're going to have to do. You could do a bio poem for that person. You're doing a report about Rosa Parks, write Rosa Parks bio poem.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And get some extra credit. And also, you know, I have the joy of being the new person in the room. And, you know, I don't know if you know me, but I'm pretty shiny most of the time.
Right, shiny.
Yeah, the rings and the hair and the kids are like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. I have the most fun in the classrooms where I walk in and the teacher's like, well, you know, they're really particular. It's going to take them a minute to warm up to you. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'm good. Just fine. And then like 10 minutes later, I got some, you know, 11-year-old telling me their entire life story. And I'm like, whoa, you warmed up quickly. The adults are probably more like weary of me than the kids. Kids are like, who is that? I want to talk to her.
Right. I want to tell her everything.
I want to tell her my whole life. I did a workshop with fourth graders and they want me back this year.
Fourth grade.
Wow. Yeah, it was fun. And one of the teachers wanted to buy my book. And so I brought her a copy of my book. And the fourth grader was like, I want to buy your book. And I was like, well, unfortunately, my book is not appropriate for your age. She was like, but you be working with kids, though. I was like, well, yeah, I do be working with kids, though. And she was like, so you don't have a book of poems for kids? And I was like, no. She was like, if you did, Miss Teresa, you would have all my allowance.
Come on, first of all, with your allowance and the claps.
She clapped me down. I'd never been clapped down by an 11-year-old. I was like, okay. No, she wasn't even 11. She was fourth grade. She's like 9. She said, but you don't want my allowance money. I was like, no, I do. And I'm going to write that book. I expect all. You want how much allowance you get?
Every dollar. I want
that's how much my book is going to cost. How much is your allowance? She's like, I get $5 a week. I'm going to write a book and it's going to cost $5. And you're going to bring me your allowance. It's great. And working with the kids also like sets me up in my heart, right? So I can work and process adults a little bit better.
Right.
And I think working with that age group is what really helped me have a healthy attitude about competition. You know, when you talk into a room full of people who are excellent at side eye and ignoring you, it makes you work for it. You know, they are random. Some days they love you.
Right.
Some days they can't stand the air you are breathing right now and wish you would stop. But it's always a good time. You know, I've had very few bad experiences. And if I do, usually it comes from the administrator or the school, sure, you know, itself. And, but I always have a great time with the kids. But I mean, that's one of the things that brings me joy, you know?
I love it. And I love how there's almost this ecosystem in your work where there are these very communal aspects to it, but that also feeds back into the things that you write, right, and how you process and everything. So I love that. For people who might be walking alongside someone mm-hmm. who is grieving, and you know, you and I talked about before we started recording just how, and I think you mentioned this too, since we've been talking, just grief shows up in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah.
For a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it is a loss of a place where we thought we had our identity built on mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
You know, and now we're like, okay, who am I?
Right.
Well, who am I now?
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be loss of a job or a position, something mm-hmm. in our career, you know, can be a relationship. It could be losing, you know, someone who's passed on. There's all these different ways, you know, we can experience the grief, the crisis of faith, so to speak, you know. I'm thinking specifically about that because I remember that being a place of grief for me in my 20s. Like, it is some things y'all had told me that's not right, and I'm upset, you know. And I was like, having that, you know, that there could be some grief involved in that too.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, what would be the stuff you'd say to people who are, maybe they're not in the grief themselves, but they're watching a person that they love, that they work with, walk through this? And I think a lot of times, you know, I don't know if that's American, that we don't have like a something for how we handle grief.
Yeah, I think we do a lot of things to distract ourselves from grief. I know I have been guilty of it, and I'm pretty sure everybody has been guilty of some form of it, where distracted by, you know, getting into these situations that you know are not going to work well, just so that you have that in the arsenal, or you distract yourself by avoiding it, you know.
Right. That's one of my favorites.
Be it in some other vice or some other person or some other thing. You know, I mean, I've been grieving my dad. He's been gone for 14 years now. And I don't know if there's a look that I get on my face when I think about him, and I think about all the things that he is missing out on and all the things that my kids are missing out on. And every once in a while, my son, you know, he'll see it and he'll say, "Tell me a Jiki story," you know, because he was like 4 when my dad passed. So he has no memory of his grandfather, whereas my daughters have all these stories. And, you know, and like, he's grieving also. He doesn't have those stories. He doesn't have those moments. So that's a different kind of grief. Yeah. And I think when people, what we tend to do, humans, is we try to make it all about one thing, you know, so like, the loss of my father is not just me grieving that he is no longer here. Mm-hmm. It is that, but it's not only that. Mm-hmm. It's also knowing that my son won't have those stories, that my nephews don't have this legacy that my daughters have, and that my daughters feel the same way, that you didn't get this. So that's a whole, these are layers of grief, right? And they're not all the same thing. I think we tend to try to make it the same thing. You know, I know, you know, losing my dad has created other things that I've lost. Like, I lost some trust. You know, survivor's guilt is real. And being the oldest is real. And, you know, when your family is in turmoil and you are present and you're trying to be there for them, and your mom makes a decision but can't utter it out of her mouth, when you have this man that you love and you have to say, "Take him off life support. And no, you cannot harvest his organs. He's in Rastafari. And if he's not all together, he can't get to Zion," you know, not realizing down the line how that decision was going to affect me in different ways. So my abandonment issues are like way layered and weird. I don't know how to fix it exactly. I know I'm not intentionally doing these things, but like, in the back of my head, it's like, people leave, people, you know, in different ways, you know? Yeah. So I think when you're walking with somebody who is dealing with grief, I think you have to sometimes just walk with them and not say anything.
Yeah.
Just being there, you know, listen, you don't necessarily have to comment. You know, sometimes people just want to say a thing and not necessarily have a discussion about it. What you don't do is say things like, "That was 14 years ago."
No.
And I can't believe you're still dealing with that kind of stuff, you know? And because that'll get a poem written about you that you will not like.
Listen, that is one of the powers of being a poet. Hello. Right there.
You want to clap back with words? I gotcha. That's what you have to make sure that you don't do.
Yeah.
And, you know, asking people if they're okay and being prepared for the answers.
Yeah.
You know, I did a human experiment about a year ago where I caught myself, and I think we all do it, you know, somebody, how you doing? And you're like, oh, I'm good. And you're really not. So I said, for a week, I'm going to be brutally honest in how I feel.
Wow.
And I scared a lot of people. And that made me feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't like making them feel that way. Mm-hmm. I think my most brutal answer was I had a really rough week. A person I dated was killed in a car accident coming back from a festival. And I was just not in a good headspace. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends was like, are you okay? And I was like, actually, no. It's like, I think I'm about at a 4. And I only thought briefly about driving into oncoming traffic. Just briefly. It was just a minute. I think I'm better now. And they were like, what the hell did you just say to me?
Right. Right.
And do I need to call you? Like, no. My thing is, if I'm saying it, I'm not doing it. Okay? So we good. But that's where I am right now. And if I burst into tears at any like random moment, don't be afraid. I'm not trying to scare you. I'm fine. I'm not fine, but I will be fine.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And like, you know, I think that kind of honesty probably is terrifying. But like, yeah, I only did it for a week because it was like, I literally made somebody burst into tears like on the spot. And I was like, that was not my goal.
Right.
But then, you know, I think I was secretly doing research for this poem that I was going to write and Nate wrote it before me.
Dang it, Nate.
I know, asking people how they do it and tell them the real answer.
Right.
And then them freaking out.
Right.
But it was just like some things we don't want to know. We think we want to know.
Right.
But we don't want to know. Mm-hmm. And us as human beings, we, especially those of us who are nurturers or who are, you don't want to make your stuff other people's stuff.
Right.
You don't want to take them through it. So mm-hmm. How you doing? I'm great.
You don't want to impose.
You know, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think me and Karen have a thing that's like, I just say, everything's great. Everything's wonderful. But in this tone that is clearly not, you know.
I think mine ends up being everything's fine. Everything is fine. Everything is fine. It's like a repeat of that. I think I have some people in my life that are like, oh no.
Yeah.
If she's saying everything is fine that many times, ain't nothing fine.
Right, right. That's cold. Not quite an SOS, but it's like, pay attention.
Totally that. And I think too, I mean, it's, you know, I'm sure one day one of us or a bunch of us will sit down and write more about the things that the poetry community has taught us about life.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like being in the poetry community has taught me better how to hold space with mm-hmm. people.
Yeah.
And that sometimes that does mean asking how they're doing and looking them in the eyes.
Right. Right.
And waiting there to see what they say.
Yeah.
And it might mean I got to put my hand on a shoulder or just stand there if they don't want to be
touched in that
moment.
Or take a seat because it's
going to
go a minute.
Yes.
Right.
You know, but like it has taught me more to hold that space and that's okay for us to hold that space for each other when we need to. Y'all, thank Teresa Davis. This is the part where like normally Matt puts some applause right here for me because this is the part where I'm like, y'all give it up for Teresa, but I always forget nobody here but me and her. So I'm giving it up for Teresa. Teresa Davis, thank you for just joining the podcast, for sharing your story and your work process with us. You know, I love me some you, and I'm just so excited to be able to share you with the podcast community. So
yay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Whew, y'all, I love me some Teresa Davis. In the before times, Teresa was the host of one of Atlanta's most thriving open mic poetry events, Java Speaks. During the pandemic, Teresa has continued to host Java Speaks as a virtual open mic held every Sunday. She is also the literary events director at the Arts Exchange, an art space that empowers artists, social justice activists, and creative entrepreneurs to engage communities with innovative artistic learning experiences and cultural exchange. You can follow Teresa on Instagram at @shepiratepoet, and you can follow Java Speaks on Instagram at @javaspeaks. To learn more about the Art Exchange, you can visit artsexchange.org. That's artsxchange.org. For this week's edition of Give Her a Crown, I want to shout out Lakota writer, actor, and comedian, Jana Schmieding. I am knee deep in watching Jana's new sitcom, Rutherford Falls, on Peacock. And if you haven't watched it, you need to. Jana is also the host of the Women of Size podcast, where she interviews people about weight stigma, marginalization, and speaks about the ills of the beauty industrial complex. Jana, thank you for the ways you use your platform to speak about your own journey and invite others to share their journey toward fat acceptance and the ways you uplift Native women in your creative work. Jana Schmieding, give her a crown. Her with Amina Brown is produced by Matt Owen for Soul Graffiti Productions as a part of the Seneca Women Podcast Network in partnership with iHeartRadio. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast.